Live from Burbank, California, where Ann Coulter comes to unwind, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he has no shame, Mark Maron.
Asua Kasuam. Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges, need machines. Thank you for all the recommendations of how to handle my illness on the blog. Well, I just put it up on the blog at markmaron.com. Not feeling that well today. Bang, I get about 15 remedies from drizzling silver something type of tincture into my throat to Asua Kasuam. Boy, I spent like an entire morning on Morning Sedition trying to pronounce Asua Kasuam. Did you know it was pronounced that? Asua Kasuam?
No, I didn't, but I remember you doing that.
Asua Kasuam. That's what it's pronounced. Jim Earl, how you doing, man?
I'm all right. You know, you know how I stay healthy from that kind of thing? The old-fashioned way with arsenic and lead paste.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. That works for some people. You know, there's no end to the number of holistic cures there are, and there's no reason to judge any of them. Some of them have been disproven out and out. Echinacea, supposedly nothing, does nothing. Vitamin E, nothing. After all those years of thinking it does. But a lot of it has to do with your head. And can I be honest with you, Jim?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Anytime.
I believe that I am more relaxed when I'm sick. I think that my body, I get so stressed out. I've been over-exercising, and someone came into this office and spread, literally was spraying germs around. You might as well just like spit on the wall or spit on, you know, who the hell knows who's got their mouth on this thing, on the mic and stuff. So there's nothing you can do once it's around. And when I get sick, I get sick. But now I'm all drained. My energy's lessened. My voice doesn't seem that well. And I'm strange. I'm relaxed kind of because I'm ill. I don't want to be ill, but I do slow down, and that's a rare thing for me is all I'm saying.
Maybe when you think you're ill, you're not ill at all, but actually healthy and normal.
No,
when
I'm
you
sick.
Think you're healthy and normal, you are ill.
Wait, so you're telling me that how I feel right now might be how I'm supposed to feel normally? Like I feel
yes.
Snot building up in my head, a slight fever, achy and painy. And,
but you feel strangely calm, don't you?
Yeah, I'm not herky-jerky.
Collected.
I'm not herky-jerky. I'm going to use that twice, man. So I made some juice soup last night. This is what I do, even though it does nothing. I made a big vat of chicken soup, and I dirtied every dish in my damn kitchen. I made it like my grandmother makes it, with chicken, dill, onions, carrots, parsnips, and somehow or another, at 10 at night, I managed to clog the damn drains. So we had to have Roto-Rooter in. So here I was getting sick, and I had to look at all the stuff that I threw away down the garbage disposal again in my backyard. I had to watch my house vomit, literally. He stuck the Roto-Rooter down there, and my house puked up vegetables and chicken parts. You would have loved it, man. It was right up your alley, is what I'm saying.
So not only did you make yourself sick, you made your house sick.
I got my house sick, and it threw up. The Roto-Rooter late at night, that's a racket. But the guy's a nice guy. He helped out. He changed. You know, it was good. It was good.
You don't have one of them garbage disposal things?
That's the problem. It's not garbage disposal is not for disposing of a body. Do you understand? It's for small pieces of food. It's like if you clean your dishes and the little left over, that's what it's really for. It's not really blades. It just grinds stuff down. And you're talking about, this is the rap I got. Hey, dude, it's a 2-inch pipe. And I jammed it packed with grease and goop. And it cost me 200 buckers, 200 smackers to get the thing unclogged. And then he came and did my kitchen, too. This is riveting stuff. Very progressive conversation we're having here. But he did a good job, and the soup's terrific. But you can't eat it, so what the hell difference does it make? Zarqawi is dead, so I guess the war is over. This is tremendous. So I hear that everyone's coming home. Abu Musab Zarqawi is gone. They blew him up, took two bombs, and somehow or another his head's still intact. How's that possible?
500-pound bombs.
Talking to Kohar, who's an old hippie paranoid guy. Sweepy Bill Kohar. That's what he's thinking when you think he's not thinking anything. He's probably not. But sometimes he's thinking like, I don't know, maybe they already had him dead. So maybe they had him on ice. Maybe that was the plan. Maybe the polls are dipping too down, and they had the plan.
And they're getting ready for the big
win.
November win. Yeah. That's what they're doing. This is the first part of their campaign.
I'm pissed off about those elections. I'm very disappointed. I'm disappointed in our candidates. Although they did a good run, I'm disappointed with the people of this country. And you know what? As long as the country remains semi-evenly divided, they're going to be able to rig these elections without Diebold machines. Because if it's like, if you're looking at a 5,000, 1,000 to 5,000 vote margin, they can just start a phone campaign. Dude, call your friends. They're organized. They could start a phone campaign to get people out to the polls to tip the scales in their direction. Something has got to give to create a landslide. They're maintaining this 50-50, 45-50. Granted, Bush's approval ratings in the toilet. Doesn't matter. On electoral politics, on the election, people are still on the fence. And they're using this immigration thing as a schism, slamming it in there, separating people on both sides. I don't know what it's going to take. I don't know what it's going to take. Perhaps a Jesus-like Democratic candidate will appear out of the ether. Not Jesus-like. I'm saying somebody...
Maybe you're right about that.
What? You don't think
a Jesus, liberal Jesus. Because, you know, I think the whole problem is with the apathy and the sheepishness of the American public, it's brought on by religion. I think, you know, there's too much religion influencing politics and the way people vote. And I think that the apathy and the low voter turnout are symptoms of that.
What a bunch of screwballs. And then people buy this stupid book. I'm not even going to entertain Ann Coulter. Some guy is on the blog. He says, look, markmaron.com if you want a blog. Why don't you take her to task about her views on Jews? I got to read the book, which means I got to, you know, expend mind space on bullet points from her book, which I don't want to do. Everybody's reacting to her. You shouldn't. That's all she wants. They shouldn't allow her on television. She's going to be remembered as an evil clown. She's just a self-promoting provocateur that has no bearing on anything. She's a clown, and by reacting to her, you're just giving her attention. And I bet you liberals buy her damn book. I bet you they do.
For sexual fantasies.
Well, sexual fantasies were just to find out what the angle is. The idea that liberalism is some sort of sickness is ridiculous. You know, competitive, heartless behavior may be what we are instinctually programmed to do, but we must make a decision to be civilized and treat people, even people that have nothing, as people. That is not a sickness. That is a choice one makes in order to maintain civilized behavior. She is the worst offender of allowing angry, stupid, narrow-minded people, belligerent people who have contempt for minorities, for people of other religions than them. She enables them, justifies their exciting hatred. And I can't play.
I hear she leg presses a ton.
She does not leg press anything. The woman is an anorexic. I think she might be a man. She's got fake boobs. She's anorexic. She's a felon.
Wait a minute. Who says they're fake?
I'm telling you, dude. I'm telling you. Look at her arms, man. There's something. She's got some serious daddy problems. I'm not going to sit here and psychopathologize this woman, but she has got some serious issues, and we're all paying for it. All right? We're all paying for her problems, for her void, her lack of ability to be human. And she's just taking it to the bank. I will say that the 9/11 wives, the four of them that she slandered in a very despicable way by saying, Hillary Clinton took a shot at her, but she talked about the women, the 9/11 widows, as she said, I've never seen people enjoying their husband's death so much. Now, this is a couple days old. I don't even want to be doing this right now. But I do want to entertain and share the response of these four women. I've interviewed two of them on mm-hmm. Morning Sedition. She called them the witches of East Brunswick. She's talking about Kristen Breitweiser, Lori Van Auken, Mindy Kleinberg, and Patty Casaza, who I think I interviewed Patty and Lori Van Auken. And they issued a statement that was very reasonable and should put it to rest for reasonably minded people, for decent people, for people who have compassion. That let's not mistake who's really sick. All right, so this is the reaction of the 9/11 widows. Quote, we have been slandered. Contrary to Mrs. Coulter's statements, there was no joy in watching men that we loved burn alive. There was no happiness in telling our children that their fathers were never coming home again. We adored these men and miss them every day. See, there you go. How the hell can America say like, screw her? How are you going to say screw her to her, to that voice of reason and compassion? You know, Coulter's problem is that these women, when they come out and they have a point of view about what happened, that she says, the reason I hate them and the reason they're evil is they're capitalizing on their husband's death because I'm not allowed to argue with them. They shouldn't be allowed to talk policy. Because I'm not allowed to argue with them because then I look like I'm exploiting or arguing with a woman who's in grief. It's not fair. So that's her problem with the 9/11 widows. She doesn't think they have a right to speak out. Yeah, that's real American behavior. Shut up. You lost your husband? Go screw yourself. We're not interested in your opinion about national security.
Yet this country lets that happen. This country lets her happen. They're buying her books in droves.
Dude, what's going on behind our backs? What's going on? Like, you know, one day it's immigration. Now Al Zakari's dead. Good. But look, they're about to, you know, auction off dead timber in 500,000 acres up there in Washington of this roadless wilderness. We're going to talk to a guy today, Rich Fairbanks. He's a firefighter and forest activist with the Wilderness Society. This is unprecedented. They've never sold off or tried to auction off timber from this is a national park. This is a roadless environment, and it was scarred by forest fire, but that's part of the natural cycle. But they might set a precedent. This is the big problem. Also, we're going to talk seriously about prison reform. Rose Braz, who is with criticalresistance.org. Man, I got stats about the incarcerated population in this country that'll blow your mind. And her angle is basically that we need to get people out of prison because they're incarcerating people for very small crimes for very long periods of time to accommodate the $40 billion a year prison industry. It's sick. It's private prisons, Wackenhut. A lot of the same prison contractors that are in Iraq. Jello Biafra will be here momentarily, the original front man of the Dead Kennedys and the spoken word wizard, real radical cat man. Sean Crowley, a tornado expert from the Weather Service, is going to be talking about the upcoming hurricane season. And you, of course, are going to be doing something. Let's get to that in a minute. Let me do the jokes. Here's a phase one. First edition of Mark Maron Show Short Order News, so you're informed for the day. Abu Musab al-Zakari was killed yesterday when U.S. warplanes dropped 500-pound bombs on his isolated safe house. Of course, by isolated safe house, we mean crowded neighborhood where kids play. Al-Zakari was identified by his fingerprints, tattoos, and super-secret al-Qaeda decoder ring. Congress gave notice to broadcasters this week by passing legislation that would multiply indecency fines 10 times. Under new FCC rules, radio stations and over-the-air television channels may not air indecent material until after 10 p.m., when children are more likely to be online talking to sexual predators. A man shouting that God would keep him safe was mauled to death by a lioness in the Kiev Zoo after he crept into the animal's enclosure, according to a zoo official. The good news is it seems God hasn't changed his policy about saving Christians from lions. That's the short order news. So what the hell is your problem, Jim?
What? What'd I do?
What are y'all worked up about?
Wheel of anger?
Why don't you say we spin the wheel of anger? Here we go. And it looks like it's going to land on emotional support animals again?
Yeah. I didn't get to it last week, so fate.
All right.
Fate brought us to this juncture.
All right. Well, hang out. Here that comes in a minute.
Welcome back to Al-Qaeda's new number two man, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Let's move up, step up, you know, it's the natural hierarchy of Air America. Let's get into this. So here we go. Emotional support animals on the wheel of anger. What the hell? You did that last week?
No, I didn't. I set it up last week, but I didn't do it.
All right, let's do it today.
Here we go.
I'm in it.
All right. All right, Mark, you know. Mark, before I get on to emotional support animals, can I take a moment to say this first?
Sure.
To the woman living across the street from me, stop beeping your damn car alarm every time you get in and out of your stupid car. It sounds like a sound effect from Benny Hill. If you don't have to get in and out of your car that many times a day, then maybe you should live in it. It's an 85 Toyota, for God's sakes, not a Ferrari. Here's a tip. Every time you leave your car, take the things you might need later in the day out of that car so you don't have to go back and forth every 15 minutes. Is your point to make everyone in your neighborhood know that you have an alarm? Well, now they know. 4 times an hour they know, exactly the same amount of times I get the urge to commit vandalism. No one wants your crappy car. Nobody wants the crap inside it, by the way, especially you, or you wouldn't keep forgetting it. Look, I don't know you, I've never met you, but I think I hate you. I know, Mark, you know, you
to your pseudo-Buddhist hippie-ass thinking, me saying I hate that woman may seem extreme and perhaps unsettling, even wrong.
Yeah.
Well, let me alleviate your fears. I don't really hate that woman, just everything she represents. Mainly her. Let's face it, Mark, everybody needs somebody to hate, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Amy Semple McPherson taught the message that hate is wrong.
Right.
And that's primarily why I hate her. For those of you who don't know who she was, here's a short history. Through the clever use of radio in the 1930s, she established one of the most successful evangelical churches in the history of tongues called the Four Square Gospel Church, right in my neighborhood, Echo Park. She was also a bipolar mess who faked her own kidnapping by white slavers and OD'd on barbiturates. Today, her legacy is responsible for luring more Mexican Americans to their spiritual and intellectual doom than Sam Walton. But even worse, now her 2 million-member church is going to tear down a street full of historic arts and crafts style houses so they can build what? A soup kitchen? No. A recreation center for poor children? No. A free clinic? No. A parking lot for the Amy Semple McPherson Church of goofballs and fake kidnappings. And that's why I hate the woman across the street. Because every time she beeps her alarm, I look out my window to see that stupid white car full of nothing important. And beyond that, a billion-dollar church full of even less. Yeah, I know that sounds like the ending to some amusing yet thoughtful essay on fresh air. And that's why I also hate Terry Gross. And that's been my thoughts on emotional support animals. I've been Durst.
Hey, man. You've been Durst. You've been great. I've been Durst. Hey, well, that was. I didn't realize that temple was still in operation.
Hell yeah. Two million members strong.
Wasn't she one of the doomsday sayers? Didn't she actually prophesy the end of the world at some point?
She ran around in a 1913 Packard with the words, Jesus is coming, get ready.
Wow, still not here yet. That's the old thing that gets me about that. And I agree with you about religion. I'm detaching even more from religion as I get older. I used to sort of entertain mystical ideas, but even those are dissipating. I would like to talk a little bit more about the Zarqawi killing, if I could end a comedy piece like that. But, you know, maybe not. We don't have that much time. Jello Biafra is going to get on the phone. Maybe we'll talk to him about it. That might be a good idea. Stick around. We're going to have Jello Biafra, the former frontman of the Dead Kennedys and spoken word wizard, after this. Hang out.
Now he buys his guns on Craigslist, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate that. Listen, folks, Jello Biafra was the original frontman of the seminal American punk band, the Dead Kennedys. He is a record label founder. He was a mayoral candidate in San Francisco. He has pissed off just about everyone that he should, including Bill Graham for performing naked and Tipper Gore in the Parents Music Resource Center for being dirty and honest and crapping on the myths that define the minions of zombies that drive this country. He was actually charged with distributing harmful matter to minors as a victim of a Tipper witch hunt. He's been doing spoken word shows since 1986, and the recordings can be found on his label at AlternativeTentacles.com. He's with us on the phone now. Welcome to the show, Jello Biafra.
Hi.
Hey, man, they killed Zarqawi. The war must be over, right?
Well, I think we've heard this before, haven't we? You know,
sure.
Mission accomplished on the aircraft carrier, which almost everybody, even in the audience at my show, assumes was an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf.
And right.
It was actually, you know, off the coast of San Diego and ate up $1 million worth of fuel until the Carl Rovians decided the lighting was just right for mission accomplished.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they pull Saddam Hussein out of the spider hole looking like Abby Hoffman on really bad drugs.
Yeah.
And suddenly, oh, hey, we've won. And, you know, they showed over and over again on the instant replays on you know, all the corporate McNews shows, they're looking at his teeth. They're looking at his teeth. They're looking at his teeth.
Yeah.
I'm really relieved to know that they've been so thorough in their searches for weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, they still can't find.
Yeah, but, you know, they did give Saddam two new caps.
Oh, really?
I'm kidding. But no,
I wonder if they had bugging devices in
them. They can actually hear his thoughts now.
So they could add that to the NSA's pile of gobbledygook, where even the intelligence community is admitting that we've got so much stuff on so many people, nobody has time to go through it all.
I know. You know, it's weird, Jello, as people are listening to our conversation right now.
Well, yeah, but that was kind of the intention.
Oh, damn it. You got me.
I mean, one thing that makes this kind of important to me is, in addition to now, here we are fighting for our right to privacy again, and I never thought we'd be in a position where here we are, one of the major battles of our generation is going to be fighting to reclaim our right to vote from electronic right-wing hackers and things.
Not just that, but
now I think we are even in serious danger of losing our right to communicate with each other. There's bills in Congress to allow, you know, the big phonies, the telecommies, Comcast, AT&T, to shut down any internet site or communication that they can't make a ton of money off of. And, of course, content itself is under attack, too. Maynard from Tool told me that after Rupert Murdoch bought out MySpace, his criticisms of George Bush on his MySpace page got censored.
Is that true?
Yeah, well, that's what he told me.
Is somebody killing a cat in your kitchen?
No. She just wants to kill me because I won't let her outside.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. I want to do a little history thing because, you know, when I was going over your biography and your press materials and stuff, a lot of people don't remember just, you know, how much they tried to crucify you and crucify people like Zappa was the guy who stood up for it during those hearings. But there was a real witch hunt around music, and they really laid into you. I had limited recollection of that. And
well, that still goes on because the former members of my old band have now gone completely money-grubbing corporate and might as well be hanging out at the Republican convention, spent years suing me because in part because I opposed putting Holiday in Cambodia in a Levi's commercial. And I recently got an inquiry from somebody they are going to hire to manage Dead Kennedys, as if that's a current existing band. And I went to that management's website, and they listed things like, oh, yeah, one of us worked with Britney Spears, one of us represents sports stars. I'm going, what is this? You know, I don't want to be forced into becoming something like that against my will.
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you a question, Joe Biafra.
I mean, it's not just the fascism of government and spying and whatnot. It's corporations thinking they own people. And, you know, even former band members wanting to become a corporation, and they've tried to both arm twist and bully me into rejoining the band against my will, which I don't want to do, which would, you know, just so they can make more money. But I think let's turn this around for a minute. I don't think I was crucified, harassed, yes, fought back, had to. But let's put this in perspective.
Okay.
Compared to somebody like Mumia Abu-Jamal, or the West Memphis Three, or the hundreds of people still being held in secret in this country because of their brown skin or their Mideastern ethnic origin, and the other 15,000 prisoners we're still holding incommunicado all over the world, people like us and myself are on easy street.
Well, yeah, but I think the point I was trying to make, Joe, was that it was stifling dissent and stifling a language of dissent in this country that is, you know, maybe you still have the freedom to do it, but the outlets become smaller and smaller. If you go to a protest, you know, you're three blocks away in a pen. If you get your message out, it's usually fragmented because of the way you have to go about getting your message out. I think the point I was trying to make, and alongside of what you were saying about your bandmates, is that these guys volunteer to be corporate whores, and they diminish the power of the music. And this happens to some of my greatest musical heroes, and I think it's horrendous.
Well, that's why I've tried to prevent it in the case of Dead Kennedy.
Yeah, sure.
Because, you know, they've pimped the actual albums off to people I don't trust or respect, and, you know, obviously the content and the songs themselves, most of which I wrote, mean more to me than it ever did to them. But again, I have to put this in a greater perspective. I can either bemoan this, and granted, I'm pretty damn angry because I continue to be mistreated and I'm not allowed to see all the books and things like that.
Yeah.
but there's bigger things going on right now.
Sure, sure.
I mean, even people who were old enough that they were adults and knew full well what was going on in the McCarthy era have said that they've never been as frightened for what this country is turning into as they are right now. And
horrendous.
It's not just Bush, it's Bushism.
It's all of them.
And that's kind of something that affects both parties in a very big way.
Right. I mean, today it comes out, Arlen Specter wrote a letter to Dick Cheney because he undermined the Senate subcommittee's investigation into these wiretapping things because...
Oh, my gosh, he wrote a letter. Oh, what courageous action. I mean, if he really wanted to go after Cheney, he'd go to Cheney's house with the media in tow and just pound on his door until Cheney opened up, Michael Moore style.
Yeah.
Or maybe recruit a few people who went after the Frankenstein monster and the Karloff movie in the 30s. You know,
yeah.
I'd love to see a whole bunch of people with torches outside of Cheney's home.
That'd be
saying,
great.
Come out, Prince of Darkness. You have lots to answer for. And meanwhile, he's probably just inside getting drunk before he goes quail hunting again or something. I don't know.
Or friend hunting. The
maybe that's why John Edwards was so spineless in that televised debate between the two, where he didn't even go after Cheney over the Secret Energy Commission.
He had a gun.
He had a map of Iraq
and
a plan written by James Baker on how to take over the oil fields, and Cheney had only been in office, two or three months at that point? Another thing that just came my way was a statement given to Congress by General Tommy Franks, who was the Supreme Commander of the U.S. Central Command, which covers the Middle East at that time, about a week after Clown Prince W. was anointed the president. And he talks about, right in this thing, about, the buildup is nearly complete in Kuwait, we've got our base in Qatar almost up to where we want it. This buildup to try and attack Iraq was going on under Clinton.
Sure, sure. Now, let me ask you something, Jella.
That made my eyes pop out of my head, even though I think a lot of the economic inequality and a lot of really screwed up stuff going on in the world, it traces back to Clinton, and it's not just Bush.
But
people saying, oh, well, we just have to put our heads in the sand until 2008, and then Hillary will save us.
That's not going to happen.
That's not going to mean a whole lot of change. Bushism.
Let me cut in for a second, and we're gonna take a quick break. And what we're gonna do is
I shouldn't have stopped talking.
No. We're gonna come back.
Get to make fun of the sponsors like I did on Janine Garofalo's show.
I don't know if you're gonna be able to hear the sponsors because we're taping. So.
I'm so disappointed.
I'm sorry.
But
we will come back and deal with the Democrats. We'll deal with your East Coast tour, and we'll deal with. I want to talk about prison in a minute. We'll be back with Jello Biafra.
Now, life is a bowl of pits. Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. Our guest on the phone is Jello Biafra, who is hitting the road in a big way, man. I mean, you've got a hell of a schedule ahead of you. You're working like every day. You're going to Pittsburgh, Buffalo, the higher ground in Burlington, Vermont. That's a good I've played that room. That's a good room.
I didn't get put back on the line with you until right when you were talking about the higher ground, so I'm not... sure what your question is. I'm assuming it's about my latest little barnstorming.
Yeah, I just said you're going to be on the road. Yeah, literally barnstorming, man. What are you going to be in a car? Are you flying? How are you going to do this?
It depends.
Yeah. Now, when you go out and perform, what's
I prefer sedan chair, but it's not always available.
Yeah. So now let me just ask you, because we're having this conversation about the Democrats now, and what is a gelatopia look like? I mean, what is the solution?
Gelatopia? I hadn't thought of that one.
I mean, people who are outspoken and people who do what we can to help raise awareness and get people thinking along the lines of truth. It's frustrating. You do get through, but you don't know whether you are facilitating real change. What would you like to see happen?
You want me to put that in a sound bite?
No, you got like 5 minutes.
I mean, even my spoken word shows, and sometimes be 4 hours long, you know, so much to say.
Don't have that much time.
And a huge chunk of that is what I would like to see happen.
How about just politically?
I would start by people checking out the platform of the Green Party. I'm down with a lot of what they want to do with, you know, better stewardship of the environment, economic equality, and, of course, a commitment to peace instead of war. Dennis Kucinich, the only halfway decent Democrat who ran for president in 2004, he even proposed a cabinet position, the Department of Peace.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. He's a great speaker.
Of defense, and I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah.
Now that farmers can make more money selling wind power than they can growing wheat, we might want to get a little more serious about that. I believe our drug laws are completely and utterly insane, and need to join the 21st century with a decriminalization not just of cannabis, but of even crack and heroin and whatnot.
You should be able to get that out of a machine at a bar.
Nah, I did. I said decriminalize.
I made a joke. What
decriminalize means is it's a regulated opiate like they do with the alcohol and the cigarette trade.
I know.
I don't think people should be allowed to drive stoned.
No.
I can tell you from experience that yes, it does inhibit your ability to drive.
Yes, it does.
But I don't think people should be doing 20-year sentences for smoking weed to ease the pain of cancer or a terrible disease.
That's absolutely right. And you know what it is, though.
But I mean, in countries like Holland, and they've tried this in other areas of Europe, where even something like heroin or cocaine is decriminalized, where you can go to a government center and get your dope on prescription and shoot up or snort it in a safe place. You know, you're sick, you're ill, you got to do what you got to do. They acknowledge that. But this also means that the addict does not have to rob and kill people to pay the mob's high drug prices, and crime goes down.
Right, and also that the reason, like I was talking about prisons.
A lot more money for rehab,
sure.
Too.
Okay.
I saw a great statistic a little while ago.
Yeah.
Of all the so-called aid we've given poor Afghanistan, we ran amok in that country, in last year, $780 million went for drug eradication.
That business is like $400 billion. All right, you got to stop. You got to stop filibustering. You
got to
cut.
You got to
cut. You
got to
stop.
And bought the drugs.
Jello.
Then it would have
stop.
What?
No, I just wanted to get a word in edgewise, because I thought that you know what you were talking about in terms of the way that they do hand out sentences.
Let me finish this point. It could cost less to buy the drugs than it does to conduct the drug war. Buy them, destroy them.
Well, it's interesting, because I'm going to talk to a guest after you who's talking about the prison industry, which is now a $40 billion a year industry that is really banking on, you know, jacking up sentences for lesser offenses, just what you're talking about. So, and they obviously own their own politicians. So in order to shift this paradigm like you're talking about, who do you like Kucinich, but who do you see maybe spearheading some sort of movement towards the sanity around this stuff? Anybody?
I think we've got to quit buying into the cartoon tabloid version of how elections should be run. It's just a horse race between two famous people trying to disguise what jerks they are while the pundits analyze their commercials instead of the issues.
Exactly.
Any change like this has to come from the ground up.
Okay.
And every election cycle, maybe in the past decade by now, more Greens have been elected to local offices. And granted, it's a small start, but if this can penetrate upstate legislatures on upward, that's where we're going to get the change.
So it's going to be the Greens against the fanatic Christians.
Well, I mean, hopefully there's going to be a lot of people who are neither fanatical on either side. I mean, my experience from covering the 2000 Democratic Convention for Free Speech TV was that a lot of the rank-and-file Democrats are not bad people, but it's just that they don't really totally have a grasp of how much their own hierarchy has betrayed them.
Absolutely.
My exit poll question to people who are all giddy after they'd nominated Al Gore for president, rah, rah, we're going to win.
Yeah.
What excites you about Al Gore? And the what I got back was, oh, yeah, he's for civil rights. Oh, he'll fight the oil companies. He's for the environment. And I asked each one a follow-up question. Do you have any idea what his record really is on this issue? And two-thirds of the people just stared at me dumbfounded and said no.
That requires homework, yeah. Do you still do I had one of our fans of our show asked, do you still ever do your version of the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pulled it back out again a while back. Maybe I'll bring it back. I don't know. I'll have to look at that. Because I do have some, because generally I just kind of riff on topics at the spoken word shows now, but I am revamping Die for Oil Sucker, which I was hoping I'd never have to read again after Gulf War number one. And there's an expansion of the intro I put on the new Ministry album for their Ass Clowns song, now called Ass Clowns in Toyland. And Message from Our Sponsor is still in the show because it's such a great way to open the whole thing and cast the proper atmosphere, where I basically do a quick version of Orson Welles's War of the Worlds as a, you know, current corporate media announcing a full-on military coup.
Oh, that was from way back. Wasn't it from the late 80s you did that?
Yeah, I think I pulled that out initially.
I remember that was like the first album of yours that I had.
Yeah,
doing spoken word. Well, if you want any of these albums, folks, it's at alternativetentacles.com. Tour dates are there. Jello Biafra is going to be all up and down the East Coast. Be careful, man. It was great talking to you.
Thanks.
You take care. All right. So, as I said, did I talk at all?
Oh, sure, he talked a lot. Yeah.
Oh, he was. It's weird when, you know, he was as efficient a filibuster as Ted Kennedy was when I talked to him. They just keep coming, and you can have a conversation alongside of what they're saying, and they can still not hear you. But I thought that he was good. It doesn't sound like he scripts anything, which I can respect, actually, a bit. You know, there could be a couple punchlines.
He had a lot to say.
He does have a lot to say. He's riffing on the truth. But when you do a four-hour spoken word show without an outline, that takes some serious nads, man, to keep talking. I wonder, I don't know if I could sit through a four-hour show. Could you sit through a four-hour spoken word show of anybody?
No.
Anybody?
I could barely sit through, like, a five-minute spoken word.
Did you imagine?
I'm not saying I don't like spoken word, but, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, okay.
See how our attention spans have changed? Back in ancient Greece, when Homer used to lay out the Odyssey, people would sit for 9-10 hours for just the first half.
Well, that's all they had.
Yeah. Why can't we get back to that, man?
And it was religion back
Let's
then.
Do that. We'll do a special on the weekend. You and I will read the Odyssey, like on a Saturday, the whole Odyssey. Wouldn't that be amazing?
I don't have to read it. I can recite it.
The Dawn's Rosy Fingers? Something like that. You can't recite it. All right, look.
You challenging me?
No, yeah, I am. Rich Fairbanks is going to talk to us about this auctioning off of 500,000 acres worth of burnt timber up in Washington that could set a precedent for encroachment on more national parks by the timber industry. Stay with us.
Now your continued donations help keep him going. Mark Maron.
Thank you. Thank you for all the donations. Man, I think I've been Biafra'd. Yeah.
Hey, man, you know, he has a lot to say. He's a great guy.
Is it like whenever you buy an album or a CD of his, there's always nine of them. You know, and it's just him talking. There's like the new CD by Jello Biafra. There's 12. It's 15 hours at one show of him talking about two things. I'm not being negative, but look, okay, here we go. 4 years ago, a wildfire burned through 500,000 acres of the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest in Oregon. It was called the Biscuit Fire. The area that is now known as Mike's Gulch is going to be open tomorrow for a timber sale to the timber industry. This is the first such auction on roadless national forest land since the Bush administration eased logging restrictions. Whether or not any companies will buy the dead timber is not the point. The point is that it could set a precedent for timber industry interests to encroach on more national parkland. With us on the phone is Rich Fairbanks, who served as ID team leader of the Biscuit Fire Recovery Project. He worked 32 years for the USDA Forest Service, many of those years putting out fires. He is now a California Forest and Fire Program Associate for the Wilderness Project. Welcome to the show, Rich Fairbanks.
Hello.
It's a hell of an intro, I tell you. you got a big intro. Now let me just try to understand something. The administration is trying to underplay this auction, I assume. They're saying probably they're dead trees, they're burned out. It's gonna help local industry. But the bottom line is, the governor of Oregon, the citizens of Oregon, conservationists, hunter and fishermen, they're all against this thing for a number of justified reasons. Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
What are they?
Well, the first thing is, this will be a precedent. If they're allowed to do this, this is a block of wild land that's a total of 367,000 acres.
Unbelievable.
And they're trying to get in the door. So and there's an additional, the type of land this is called inventoried roadless area. Mike Skulch is in an inventoried roadless area. And all told, across the United States, there's 61 million acres of inventoried roadless area.
What does that mean?
It's an area where there are no roads, and in almost all cases, there has been no timber management, no tree farms established. It's wild land. It's what's left of our wild land.
Wow. Okay. So now, from what I understand of this situation, most of these trees are dead.
That's true.
And you were part of the effort to control this wildfire 4 years back.
Actually, I was the leader of the team that decided, well, we presented alternative as to what to do after the wildfire.
Okay. Now, it's like I lived in the Bay Area. There was a bad fire up in the Headlands. And the truth of the matter is that it regrows itself, that there's actually a certain logic to the fire in the eye of God, if you believe that kind of stuff, and that eventually this will all be restored and beautiful and remulch itself. And they're just using this as an excuse, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Scattered through the Mike's Gulch area, there are live trees that survived the fire, great big old 400-year-old trees, that sort of thing. And they're putting out seed right now. And we're finding, I've been up there looking around, there are 100 to 300 seedlings, conifer seedlings per acre, coming out of those old grandfather trees that survived the fire.
Now,
and of course, those trees, those seedlings have the genes for fire resistance, and they're very well adapted to the site because they're the natural trees that grow there.
So now, how are they just going in and doing this? I mean, can't the state government do anything, or are there forces within it that have sold the state out, like Senate on the Senate level? What's going on with that?
Well, no, the governor has made it very abundantly clear that he does not want this sale and some of the other sales sold until the whole roadless question is resolved in the state of Oregon.
Now, what is the roadless question?
It is, what are we going to do with these roadless areas?
Well,
we put them into statutory protection, as in a wilderness area, a designated wilderness area, or whether we put them into some other land allocation.
But it feels like this is a pressing issue. I mean, we're talking about tomorrow, aren't
we? Definitely. This is a very pressing issue.
So what can we do?
Well, you can certainly, your listeners can certainly write or call their congressmen and their senators and ask them what's going on.
Yeah, because I read somewhere recently that they're trying to sell off a chunk outside of Zion National Park in Utah for development. I mean, this is happening for a lot of different reasons to a lot of national park space.
Well, there's a big push on to sell national forest lands.
Yeah.
Ostensibly to help schools out, or there's some various excuses given. But yes, there are people who are in the federal government now who are trying to sell federal land, pretty big chunks of federal land.
So, but this isn't really a sale. This is they're presenting this as this would be them supposedly, you know, honoring the forest, and but yet you know, taking what they need out of it.
Well, yes, these post-fire salvage sales are always billed as so-called restoration. I've been in the business for 32 years, and it has not been my experience that they restore anything. They generally put a lot of slash on the ground to fuel the next fire and make a mess, and generally they head the area in the direction of a tree farm rather than a natural forest.
Oh, I see. So what happens? Slash is just like sawdust and what? What is slash?
Oh, limbs and tops and things like that. You see, when a post-burn forest is logged, you can only get value out of just a very few of the biggest logs.
So then what they do after they create this, they come back and they do it again? Is that what you're saying by making a tree farm situation?
Right. They would plant it to a uniform spacing of a commercial desirable species, and then you'd come back and cut it. In 50 years, you'd clear cut it.
All right, so they're basically prostituting this roadless habitat for their own means, and if they do enough of them, they can have turnover almost every year in the future if they do their planning right. But what the cost of that is, you lose these beautiful areas where people go and respect the ecosystem, fish, and hunt with a certain amount of respect, and many of the species, I imagine, will be compromised if this happens, right?
Oh, yes. There's some major problems with ecosystem function under this sort of scenario.
Well, tell us a little bit about this, the Wilderness Society, before we go here.
Oh, well, the Wilderness Society has over 200,000 members, and we work to keep the wild areas wild. That's basically it in a nutshell. And in the current situation, as I said, we have 61 million acres in the United States, that's inventoried roadless area. It is not protected by any statute. And we'd like to get probably most of that into the wilderness system because we just don't feel there's enough wild areas left in the United States. We're urbanizing so quickly here in the West, we feel that we need to put aside a good chunk of what's left.
It's interesting to me that you obviously are a guy who's spent his life appreciating just the awe-inspiring nature of these kind of areas, but most people who don't travel to them, it just baffles me that they can be that simple-minded as to not care. That if these places, people don't seem to realize that once these places go, that's it. They don't come back in the form they're in.
Yeah, that's true. And we here in the West, most of our cities get most of their drinking water from such areas. And, of course, they do also serve as sort of the lungs of the West in terms of kind of helping to filter and clean things. They're really quite important. They're just way in the backcountry, so people tend not to notice them. But
now,
they are, as you point out, they're quite valuable.
Yeah. Now, Rich Fairbanks, it's great talking to you. Is there a website that if they go to the Wilderness Society website, is there information there? Is there someplace they can go?
Yes, www.wilderness.org. They'll find a lot of very interesting stuff there. It's an excellent website.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be back in a moment Sean Crowley, a little more environmental talk. He's a tornado expert. He's going to address the upcoming hurricane season, which is going to be bad. We'll be back in a second.
And now, step back from the vehicle, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it. Well, look, folks, I spent time in New Orleans. It was eye-opening. Hurricane season has begun, and the National Weather Service predicts another year of enormous storms. But today, we will talk with a tornado expert who feels that we should broaden our view a little bit in terms of what you'd be afraid of in storm season. In storm season, meteorologist Sean Crowley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Sure. Now, let me just make sure I understand something. You aren't disputing that hurricanes are dangerous, right?
No, not at all, not at all. But, cougars are dangerous, Mark. Hurricanes are just the flavor of the month, you know what I'm saying?
Well, it's hurricane season, and Katrina was like the biggest hurricane.
Yes, I get it. Hurricanes are deadly. Ooh, I better run, or Hurricane Osiris is going to get me.
All right, you can't make light of the destruction they've caused, okay?
Okay, fair enough. But yeah. Tornadoes are destructive, too. You just never hear about them.
Why do you think that is, then, Sean?
I don't know. They're not sexy, you know? Nobody sits on a beach and drinks a tornado. Nobody goes to watch the Miami Tornadoes play basketball.
Uh-huh.
Denzel Washington didn't star in a movie called Tornado.
You know, that movie didn't actually have anything to do with hurricanes.
Oh, no, believe me, I know.
Uh-huh.
They just call it that to get people into the theaters. They got to get the butts in the seats, you know,
uh-huh.
And everybody loves hurricanes.
Okay, all right. Now, you've said you have a problem with hurricanes being given proper names.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What other storm gets a proper name?
Yeah.
You know, people remember Rita or
right.
Ivan or
okay.
Katrina, but nobody says, honey, we can't name the baby F3. Remember that horrible twister in Oklahoma?
All right, not fair. All right. Maybe it's because there's so many hurricanes they need to keep track. How about that? Maybe there's just so many of them.
That's a good point. Hey,
yeah.
You know how many tornadoes last November were in Kentucky alone?
How many?
50.
Okay.
You know what their names were?
I don't know.
Tornado. Hurricanes get special treatment because the institutionalized meteorologism that runs rampant throughout this country.
Meteorologism?
It's the oppression of a type of storm, Mark.
That sounds like racism.
No. This is much worse than racism.
Wait, come on. That's got a little bit offensive, Sean.
It's institutionalized. It's built into everybody. I mean, you're prejudiced against tornadoes, and you don't even know it.
I don't have anything against tornadoes.
Spell tornadoes.
I don't want to spell
tornadoes. Come on, no. Spell it.
Fine. All right. TORNADO. Is there an E when it's plural? Or?
Look in the mirror now, you meteorologist.
Wait. What would you like to see change then about the public's perception of tornadoes? All right.
Well, there's a number of things I would love to change, but as a starting off point, first thing we need to change is the media's liberal bias against them.
There is no liberal bias against tornadoes, Sean.
All right.
What?
How many times have you talked about hurricanes on your show?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Several times.
Uh-huh.
Sid Katrine talked about Katrina. You've had guests on talking about that.
Yeah.
How many times you've talked about tornadoes?
I don't know. I don't know if I've ever talked about tornadoes on the show.
Why don't you just make my point for me, Mark?
Look, we are.
Why don't you just make it for me?
I'm out of time, man. I can't.
Of course we're out of time. You know, if you had a hurricane guy and you'd give him a full 5 minutes.
Well, thanks for being here, Sean.
You are worse than Anderson Cooper.
Yeah, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah. What the hell is that?
That man's very angry.
I got to tell
you. Very angry.
Well, you know, you get into a specific line of work, you can understand his bitterness, but I thought we were going to have some information. I thought we were going to get some things done.
Well, if you're prejudiced against tornadoes, why don't you just come out and say it?
You know, Jim, I am sick. Do you know that? I'm not even a good sick person. I'm not, I kind of complain and I get really sick. I don't get a little sick. I cannot stand people that are like, I had that cold. It lasted 2 days. Really? It lasted 2 days? Colds don't last 2 days. There's no 2 day cold.
No, there's 2 days for them in the house and then another 2 weeks out infecting people. That's what they're talking about.
No, there's 3 days coming on until you level off into sickness, and then there's another 3 days of sort of tolerable sickness, and then if you're lucky and you don't smoke, another 3 or 4 days for it to go away. But if you smoke, then it could be months of coughing up things that you don't understand.
Hands off the doorknobs. Hands off the doorknobs.
So did I talk? I wanted to talk more about this. This is Rick Perry, the governor of Texas.
Yes.
$5 million. $5 million. He's going to install hundreds of night vision cameras on private land along the Mexican border, and put the live video on the internet so that anyone with a computer who spots illegal immigrants trying to slip across can call a toll free number. Why can't you just have a button where you can shine a light on them and follow them with it? Why can't they make it a really interactive game?
I'm going to call every 5 minutes. Hey, I saw a rabbit.
Yeah.
Saw a rat. Was that a rabbit or a guy? I can't tell. Anyway, here it
is. But this
I'm
is
sorry.
So close to being this is the culture of the rat. Don't you see what this is? This is it encourages people to be part of a rat system. That to blindly stand behind, anonymously identify somebody and poke a computer pointer at them, say, I got one, and call up and say there's one down there?
I think that's absolutely shameful, and I understand your point. Did they get some sort of reward for that?
I don't know. You know how much it was?
That'd be great if you get a reward.
Apparently
you know?
They're going to honor the reward for Zarqawi, for killing Zarqawi.
Really? Well,
$25 million. I don't know who gets it. I can't imagine it's the guys who dropped the bombs. It must be the guys who led them there. $25 million. That's a hell of a reward.
Probably going to the guy who's going to replace him.
Maybe if they paid the troops a few extra bucks, they wouldn't have a bad attitude, as some of them do.
Troops are doing this for the experience, Mark.
Troops are doing it. Many of them, Jim.
They're interns.
Honestly, many of them do it because they have no other way of making a living.
They could go to prison.
Huh?
They could go to prison.
Well, that's easy. They might do that when they come back, depending on how they're treated by the government. You understand? They might end up in prison.
Learn a trade in the prison.
Yeah, who's Mr. Buzzkill now? I think that'd be me. I'm the Buzzkill.
Been a Buzzkill. I've always been Mr. Reality.
You're trying to have a funny conversation. I just keep going bang, boom, like, oh, there's a little reality. How about a little more reality?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Buzzkill, my coffee addiction before we went on the show.
6 pots a day is not healthy, Mark.
Pot and a half.
Pot and a half. You said 6 pots earlier.
Pot and a half.
Now you're so hallucinating because of the caffeine. You don't know what the hell you're talking
about. Caffeine has been proven not to be bad for you. It may cause stress.
It's not been proven. What are you, Karl Rove, spitting out, you know, just
false
facts left and right?
But you won't shy from spitting out environmental science left and right, or categoric evidence of greenhouse gases from cow farts.
It's right here on the paper.
Yeah, well, so look, caffeine over a long period of time, right here on the paper, does not cause heart problems.
Written in red crayon does not impress.
Look, you're right, I'm right. You base your opinions on justified and well-researched truth. This was a scientific experiment. Because you have chosen...
By chock full of nuts.
...to live in... you live a life of self-enforced denial because you think it's good, all right? It's not my problem that you're not having a good time. I'm saying that you drink tea and you don't eat the birdies because you have decided that that's the right way to live, and that's fine. But you know what? Clearly you want coffee. Clearly you want a little soup.
Every once in a while I do have a sip of coffee, but, you know, I don't drink six pots a day.
Well, hey, what's in the bag on the desk? What's in the bag over there?
It's the same bar of dark chocolate that I've been working on for, like, a week.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to believe that. You know, people with drug problems don't always tell the truth. So that's the same bag, huh?
It sure is.
Same bag you've been working on for a week.
Yeah, it is.
Uh-huh, that's a good one, Jim.
Are we all right? Are we okay?
I don't know, man. What's happening? What segment are we on? What's coming up next? Holy Christ. Oh, this we have a fairly intense segment coming up. We're going to talk about prisons, and I'm going to read some statistics. This woman, Rose Braz, is going to be on. I've been wanting to talk to her. She is she's from the prison reform activist group, criticalresistance.org. So stick around for that. And that is not the same bag of chocolate.
He's leaking moisture, Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. Here's some disturbing statistics. According to the Federal Justice Department's Bureau of Justice Statistics annual report, prison and jail inmates at mid-year 2005. Last year, the nation's prisons and jails held 2,186,230 prisoners. That's an increase of 56,428, or 2.6%, over mid-year 2004. 738 per 100,000 of the population was incarcerated last year. That is up from 725 per 100,000 the year before. As of mid-year 2005, one in every 136 U.S. residents were imprisoned. If this ratio were to exclude children from the total population, that percentage would be one in every 100 residents. These are mind-bending numbers. The U.S. has, listen to this, the U.S. has the most actions criminalized of any country and routinely doles out mandatory sentences lasting decades. On any given day in America, more than 7 million of its residents are under some form of supervision or the correction system. And a lot of people don't realize this, that prisons are privatized, prisons are a business, and they are a business that has made a fortune. Despite a drop in violent crime, the prison industry has ballooned into a $40 billion a year industry because of several reasons we'll talk with our guest about. Incarcerating people, as I said, is big business. The way the state and federal legislators support the prison industry is by putting more people in prison for longer periods of time or by executing extreme mandated sentences for minor crimes. The prison system is no longer about rehabilitation. As federal assistance programs shut down and enforcement gets stricter, desperate people in desperate circumstances because of economic realities are incarcerated with no hope of reentering society, and that's the way the prison business likes it. So let's talk about solutions. Rose Braz is the director of Critical Resistance, a national grassroots organization seeking an end to this nation's reliance on prisons as answers to social, political, and economic problems. Welcome to the show, Rose Braz.
Thank you for having us.
You bet. So with the introduction of private prison companies like Wackenhut, how has the prison system changed over the years?
Well, I mean, with privatization definitely comes more of a shield from public scrutiny and public oversight.
Mm-hmm.
With privatization, things are just more, there's an even more apparent economic interest in keeping people in prison. But it's also important to note that, you know, public prisons have a lot of the, you know, same problems, right? And I think the fundamental problem is that locking people in cages at a cost of what, you know, you put forward there, $40 billion, is not creating safer communities, whether those prisons are public or private, and certainly there are additional issues that come with private prisons. But I think the core issue is really that locking people in cages is not creating safer communities, and it's costing us a fortune at the expense of social services that truly could build safety in our communities.
Well, let's talk about that, because, you know, here in California, I guess Schwarzenegger has correction spending has grown more than 65%. That obviously he is in cahoots with these business interests, and obviously the federal government cutting social programs, and I don't know how much faith-based initiative money is going into prison rehabilitation or moving people back into society or drug rehab. How do we begin to depopulate the prisons and engage in social programs that don't exist any longer?
You know, I think what's most interesting about this issue is that it is not rocket science.
Right.
We know what will keep people out of prison. We know, you know, communities where people have good access to quality education, they have job opportunities, they have a place to live, they have food on the table. Those communities have lower crime rates than other communities. And the same thing, you know, across the country, and actually, you know, across the world.
Yeah.
So we know fundamentally what would build safer communities, and we also know fundamentally how to reduce the number of people in prison. Just one example is here in California, every year we send about 70,000 people to prison for technical violations of parole. So those are folks not committing new offenses. Those are people who, in some way or another, have violated the conditions of the parole, which could be as simple as missing a meeting with a parole officer or having a dirty urine test or not being in the county to which you were paroled. These minor things in California you go back to prison for. And this is why our prison population is so huge. So just changing that one thing could dramatically impact the number of people in prison.
Why don't they do it?
There's no political will to do it, and there's no political courage to do it. I think what's most interesting to me is that we now have poll after poll after poll that shows people across the country want to invest in rehabilitation and preventative services rather than locking people in cages. We have polls that show prison spending is the number one area that taxpayers want to see cut, and education spending is the number one area they want investment to increase. We see rejection of prison construction bonds over and over again. So we're seeing this public opinion shift, which is slow, but it's really becoming apparent. And what's not happening is the elected officials are not following the lead of the people. I mean, most recently here in California, you had our Assembly Speaker, Fabian Nunez, who's good on a lot of issues,
yeah,
propose an enormous prison construction bill. And when he proposed it, he said, I know voters won't go for this, so I'm going to use this other mechanism to bypass voter approval. I mean, he introduced a bill where he said, I know voters will not support this, but he introduced it in the name of Californians. And that's, you know, we need much more political courage to do some of these small reforms, and obviously what will engender that political courage, I believe, is a grassroots movement that demands it, and that's what we are trying to build at Critical Resistance.
All right, well, let me ask you some yeah, okay. The dog wants some airtime. It's okay. It's no problem. Look, let me ask you some practical questions. So, everybody knows someone in their life who has a drug problem. Everybody knows someone in their life who's been in trouble with the law. Everybody knows the struggles that these people live with and the lives they lead. Now, is the problem essentially being presented by politicians is that it's cheaper to keep people, it's cheaper for the state to keep people in jail than it is to put money into social programs that other people don't see as effective? How do they say that they can't do this?
Well, I think they don't say they can't do it. They won't do it. I mean, another clear example here in California is Proposition 36, which voters passed several years ago. It provides for treatment rather than imprisonment for certain folks convicted of drug offenses. And recent studies have been shown that it saves taxpayers $2.50 for every $1 invested. So those types of facts are coming out of the Department of Corrections itself and studies it's commissioned. Yet right now we're in a fight over how much funding they're going to put into Proposition 36 this coming year. And so the logic and the way to save money is clear. Treatment. Prison education saves $2 for every $1 you invest in it. These studies are all out there. But it's not the political will to invest in those things is what's not out there and what, you know, we really need to demand of our elected officials.
So the issue is that these politicians don't want to appear soft on crime.
That is the issue.
That's the whole thing.
In my opinion, that's the whole thing.
Because
there's no logic to it. There's no reason to it. I mean, there are other political issues at play in terms of what you pointed out, business interests. Prison Guards Union in California is the number one contributor to state legislative races. But ultimately what it does come down to is this morbid fear, you know, of being perceived as the slightest bit soft on crime rather than really trying to build safe communities.
Right. Compassion is not popular.
Compassion is not popular. Rationality is not popular. Logic is not popular.
Tough love, ignorance, narrow-mindedness, denial. Well, look, you know, you're doing a bold thing, and I certainly will send people to your website. And I just don't. When I read these statistics, which I pulled off, I don't remember what website, but the interpretation I read was from a socialist paper, so it was very indicative of the class struggle. But this has been the way the war on drugs and the prison business has been the way that they've, you know, gone. They've imprisoned. That's why so many poor people are in prison, and it's a big business, and it's a tragedy. And I just hope that we can change that. So thank you for joining us, Rose Braz.
Thank you for having us. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So you can go to her website there. You know, I know people who've been in jail.
Oh, I believe that.
No, I mean, who the hell doesn't? You don't know anyone who's been in jail?
My brother was.
Was he? But for activism or what?
No. Wrote some bad checks.
Did you watch Larry? You're lying.
No, I'm not.
Really? That's funny.
Yeah, but it was in Texas. Texas, what a hell to be in prison there. Not prison, jail.
Anywhere's a hell. Did you watch Larry King? Larry King was live at San Quentin last night.
I'm not gonna degrade myself watching that crap. Are you kidding? Larry King?
Don't you watch just Surreal Life?
Yeah, that's
And American
great.
Idol?
Yeah.
All right.
Because I know what that's about. But Larry King, nobody, you know, people actually take that for real. They think that's real.
Whatever it was, he was sitting there in the courtyard of San Quentin with real inmates. And it was very interesting to see these guys. They were all killers. And they were all convicted killers. And most of them weren't going to get out anytime soon. Most of them had given their, had turned to Jesus. And none of them were willing. The fascinating thing about it was none of them were willing to talk about drugs in prison. None of them were. They knew that Larry was going to leave and that the fellows were watching it, you know, in the rec room. So everyone was very careful about what they said about being in the big house. But what was interesting is that they did focus on guys who were trying to mind their own business and do constructive things. I have to think, now I am a believer in rehabilitation. I believe that, I don't know what the odds are, and I could probably check the numbers, but there's a lot of people doing a lot of time for stuff that does not require that much time that could be, you know, functioning members of society if they were given the chance. I believe that.
The American prison system was founded on rehabilitation.
Not anymore.
After they rebelled against brutality and debtors' prisons and the debtors' prisons of Britain. I mean, it's Dickensian now because people are they pretty much are debtors' prisons. If you're poor. You know, you don't have the same chances. Something's going to happen.
Exactly. And it's going to get worse. I mean,
you don't have representation, and then the huge prison lobby influences the California legislature for one thing. I mean, you know, they're all in bed with the prison lobby.
And then the private prison industry. I mean, the way that they've shifted legislation, the way, you know, bankruptcy legislation, in terms of people not being able to declare personal bankruptcy, anybody is just, you know, one divorce, one death away from being broke and desperate. One without any recourse. I mean, bankruptcy courts are now basically they collect money for the credit card companies. Mm. So how far are you from prison? How far is anybody really away from that? And these prison companies they definitely have alignments with state governments. These are huge. Wackenhut runs a security in my mom's condo complex and owns prisons. I don't know what the hell that means. My mom's kind of in a prison. It kind of is a prison, a condo complex, if you look at it. It really depends how you look at it and what you consider
gated
life.
Gated communities.
Yeah. It's kind of a gated community, yeah. But it's got a little fake lake and, you know. Is it a gated community? Not really. It's in Florida, you know.
Fake lake.
Fake lake. You can crawl under the fence. You know, what are you going to steal?
A lot of drugs.
You know what I mean? A lot of drugs. A lot of Valium in those cabinets. Hey, look, we're going to come back. We'll do the short order news. We'll do
Oh, I feel like, was my energy okay?
Your energy's fine. You know what?
I'm a little sick.
You were battling Jell-O.
Dude, the guy's rude.
He's a guest. Let him ramble.
But we got a show. We'd still be rambling now.
I know.
The McCorporations are going to eat all of us for dinner. They're going to put us in fryolators. I'm going home now.
Wow. I can't believe my f***ing ears. Mark's short order news is coming up right after this f***ing break.
MapQuest sucks. Mark Maron.
MapQuest sucks?
Yeah, it sucks. I'm giving wrong directions.
Jesus, Jim, what are you
talking about? Wrong directions.
I don't even know how the hell we got by without MapQuest. Yeah, people used to just tell you. Yeah, just say, like, just go down the 10 and get off at Clover Field and take a right.
You just have to read a real map, not MapQuest.
Look.
With ads and where the, you know, McDonald's is. And
listen to this.
Motel 6 is in your neighborhood.
Well, just get the printable version and just get to where you need to go. It's good if you don't know where you're going.
Where's Jell-O? He'd go off on this subject. MapQuest sucks.
Nick, MapQuest is for queer.
I am Governor Jerry Brown.
Wait, McMapQuest is for people that buy the corporate agenda and their corporate cars and their McCars. Everyone's driving in their McCars to McMapQuest, going to their McJobs. Hey, let's go on McVacation. No? What? I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, that's fine, man.
I don't mean to mock him. He's a good guy. He's a good guy.
He's a great activist.
He's outspoken, and he's got cats. I'm covering my new couch. I got a new couch. I'm just waiting for one of them to pee on that. Yeah, I can sense it now. I know when they're kind of looking at me like, yeah, you know what I'm doing? You know what this look is? I'm going to pee on something.
Isn't there something you can do about that? Like, you know, cut something off or go in there with a knife or something?
Did I mention that I have four cats?
Yeah.
Four.
Yeah, what about
I can't even figure out how to keep the damn fleas off them. I love the cats, but yesterday Boomer was in my office, and I was sitting there doing my work in the garage, and I heard him behind me, and he was sort of in some place, and I look over, and he looks at me, and he's like, yep, I'm peeing on your guitar chords. And that's what he did.
What's the love about that? That is the most insidious pet I've ever heard. I mean, that's not lovable.
One time Monkey was on the couch just looking at me like, hey, how's it going? You know what I'm doing? Peeing on the couch.
I think you
get a load of that.
Self-image problems. You have to let these cats pee all over.
Guess who's
got to
wash the cushions? That might be true, Jim. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the price to pay is, okay, I love pets. I love these cats. They sleep on the bed. I like them. I really get a kick out of them. I love all of my cats. I have to be honest with you. Now, is that the price I got to pay? Is occasionally going, where is that now? Is it against getting up at 6 in the morning to walk a damn needy canine who's slobbering and drooling on everything?
Yeah.
And every 5 minutes, I got to go poop. And then if you let him out, it's like, well, now we got, how often do you got to clean up
that
poop?
That's not your only choice. You can take these cats to the doctor, you know, special doctor, and
have their bladder removed?
No.
Could you please could you make it so my cat pees out of its mouth? What are you talking about?
Must be something you can do. I mean, just break them mentally. Emotionally, break them.
You ever tried to break a cat? You can't break cats.
Sure.
Cats break you. Look at me. Look at me. I'm sitting here accepting the fact that they pee on things as part of the game. I'm broken. I'm done.
Turn on the Jell-O Biafra 4-hour spoken word album. You know.
Wow. Yeah. Listen here, Mr. McCat. I'm telling you something. Stay away from corporate vittles.
So are they all fixed? They're all fixed, right?
Ugh, that's enough of this. I was going to talk about David Berg's father, but I was going to talk about Coulter and her attack on liberalism. See, the thing is when we talk about things like prisons, and when you talk about having faith in at least, without looking at the numbers, statistically, if somebody wants to recover from drugs and alcohol, it's a long shot. It really is, in the long term, a long shot that they are going to have success in that. But 10% do. Now, are those 10% worth salvaging at the cost of 90% relapsing? You know, this is the difference between liberals and conservatives. The bottom line is conservatives are like, look at the numbers, screw them. They're all bad people. I'd rather put the 10% that might be okay in jail with the 90% that are definitely going to screw up than risk this or that. You know, that's the bottom line.
And they put 90% of themselves in there.
Right.
With Rush Limbaugh and the rest of them.
And it's like you have the father of that guy. Is it Dave Berg? Is that the kid who was killed in Iraq by Zarqawi?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. His father is Michael Berg.
is now saying that the death of Zarqawi will incite a new wave of revenge. George Bush and Al Zarqawi are two men who believe in revenge. Zarqawi felt my son's breath on his hand as he held the knife against his throat. Zarqawi had to look in his eyes when he did it. George Bush sits there glassy-eyed in his office with pieces of paper and condemns people to death. That, to me, is a real terrorist. So this guy is one of those guys that's like, you know, any killing is going to lead to other killings. And people like Ann Coulter would say, that's pathological to think that way, to have that kind of hope in the possibility of peace working. Hey, let's do the short order news part two, can we? Here we go. Get informed. Get on it. Here we go. Switching from funny to horror to funny.
You're hopping in your seat.
Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed yesterday when U.S. warplanes dropped 500-pound bombs on his isolated safe house. As a result, the biggest threat to the safety of U.S. soldiers remains Donald Rumsfeld. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed yesterday when U.S. warplanes dropped. I said that already. So you see, folks, I guess the point is about the outside of the safe house is suburbs really isn't any safer than living in the city, is it? Congress gave a notice to broadcasters this week by passing legislation that would multiply indecency fines 10 times. Federal Communications Commissions can levy from $32,500 to $325,000 per incident, depending on whether or not the station has paid contributions to the GOP. That, my friend, is true. A man shouting that God would keep him safe was mauled to death by a lioness in a Kiev zoo after he crept into the animal's enclosure, according to a zoo official. This was the first and last episode of the new Fox reality show, Zealots Do the Damnedest Things. Experts call the man's death proof that God does exist. There's going to be a new web game where they're setting up a $5 million worth of web cameras on the border of Mexico and Texas, and you can go online and catch Mexicans crossing the border.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah, well, tune in. All right, tomorrow, folks, we've got Robert Greenfield on his Timothy Leary biography. Svetlana will be here, and Bobby Ghosh from Time Magazine's Baghdad Bureau Chief. Good night, sheeple. I'm going to jail.